After nearly 30 years now, genetic genealogy has helped bring closure to a local mom whose daughter was murdered in the early 1990s. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
I hope you brought some hell.
That's nearly all Sharon Lee could manage to say at a Snohomish County Sheriff's press conference yesterday morning, announcing the arrest of a suspect in the murder of her 15-year-old daughter, Melissa, nearly 30 years ago. A day earlier, cold case investigators arrested Bothell resident, 62-year-old Alan Edward Dean, for the 1993 murder of Melissa Lee.
But I am glad this is a good day that we're one step closer to bringing justice for your daughter and for your family.
Melissa was home alone April 13th, 1993. She had planned to have a friend over for a sleepover, but that fell through. When mom called around 9:30, everything was okay. But when mom got home just after midnight, the front door was slightly open. There were signs of a struggle, but no signs of Melissa. Her body was found in a ravine the next day on Mukilteo Boulevard in Everett. She had been strangled and had ethyl ether and heptane chemicals in her system. Detectives were led to Dean with the help of C.C. Moore and Parabon Labs through the use of genetic genealogy, identifying a possible suspect.
In this case, the crime scene DNA was SNP genotyped, and the file was uploaded to the GenMatch website, where it was compared against the people participating in that website. From this, we received a list of cousins to this unknown DNA contributor. By building their family trees and looking for patterns and intersections, we were able to reverse engineer a potential identity of this DNA contributor. We then turned that over to the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office as a tip, and they proceeded to their full investigation.
The results are treated like a lead by investigators, who then watch the suspect and hope for a lucky break. In this case, it was Dean's discarded cigarette. Detectives quickly grabbed the used butt, ran it against the crime scene DNA, and got a match to Dean, a man whose name they recognized right away.
Yeah, his name came up early on in the investigation in 1993. He was talked to a couple times by detectives, but they hit a roadblock and things went cold.
Detective Brad Wellvonte with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Major Crimes Unit says Dean also had a concerning criminal history.
8 years previous, he was in Arizona, and there was a similar circumstance involving a sexual assault of a minor.
Dean lived on Madison Street in Everett in 1993. Dean lived not far from where Melissa's body was found back in 1993. He worked a day shift at Boeing in Everett before the killing. Snohomish County Prosecutor Adam Cornell says it's a strong case.
This isn't our first rodeo when it comes to a partnership like this. There was a mention, at least implicitly, of the successful investigation and the prosecution of William Talbot. That was a partnership between our office and the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office. And frankly, that was, in my understanding, the first trial of its kind in the country to use genetic genealogy. And we're proud to work with the Sheriff's Office on this case.
As for Melissa's mom, Sharon, she's grateful.
Long enough to see this happen.
Skyro Radio's Hannah Scott reporting, and she joins us live. And Hannah, investigators are still asking for some help from the public. Why?
They are, just because it helps to build these types of cases. Even though they have that DNA match, they got that initial lead for that suspect from C.C. Moore and that genetic genealogy, which is a fairly new kind of science that they're using in these types of cases. So just kind of a backup. And what they're looking for is anybody who might have known him in the early 90s, back in the 1993 time, or recognizes him from his pictures back then, or even his current picture now. Anybody who knew anything about him possibly having access to ethyl ether and heptane chemicals. Those are the chemicals that were found in Melissa's toxicology report. They are kind of an aesthetic almost, that they make you drowsy, kind of work like a chloroform, I think, if you use them on people. And then also anybody who may have known about him using a nighttime talk line, one of those phone chat with women kind of calls. Anybody who knows anything like that, they're asking for to call the Snohomish County Sheriff's Department. You can see the full list at MyNorthwest.com.
What do we know about this suspect?
We know that they talked to him initially back in 93. He didn't live too far away, and they didn't really detail exactly why they talked to him. The current investigator, who wasn't around during the initial part of the case, said that those initial investigators did talk to Dean. For whatever reason, they hit a roadblock and they had to abandon that part of it. We also know that he was being investigated for sexual assault involving a minor in Arizona from 8 years earlier, just 8 years ago from now, and that he fled after the investigators interviewed him there in that case. So he's also being looked at over in Arizona.
This genetic genealogy technology that's used to, you know, crack cold cases is relatively new. I know you've covered several here in the past few years. How many has Snohomish County been involved in now?
Now, this makes the third case for Snohomish County where there's been an arrest. They have, of course, the big one, which was the first ever to go to trial in the United States, was William Talbot. He was arrested essentially much in the same way as this particular case for the murders of Jay Cook and Tanya Van Kylenberg. They were a British Columbia couple who came down for an overnight visit to Seattle and were found murdered. I think it was more than 30 years ago. He was convicted just this last year. There's another similar case involving a young girl from the 70s who was had a man arrested in. Now, they said yesterday at this press conference, there are seven other cases just in Snohomish County alone that are currently being investigated with the help of genetic genealogy. And the bottom line from investigators here is anybody who thinks they might have gotten away with something like this back in the 70s or 80s, 90s, don't think again, because this is really working very fast. This is CeCe's 118th case.
Let's cover Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. Hey,
oh, let's go.
Choke points now, and it's never too early to start talking about an upcoming full closure of I-5. It's happening in about a month in Fife, and you should start planning for it now. Yes, Sully?
Yeah, both directions of I-5 are going to be closed on back-to-back weekend nights. This is in the last weekend of August, and you can never prepare enough for a full closure of the freeway. The freeway is going to be closed between Highway 18 and Federal Way and 54th Avenue in Fife. That's a 4.5-mile stretch of I-5. Now, it's only a nighttime closure between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m. on Friday, August 28th, and Saturday, August 29th. But the impacts are going to be felt.
We really want people to be aware that this closure is coming up, because we know how disruptive an I-5 closure can be.
That's Laura Newborn with the Washington of Transportation. She says workers need these 18 hours to place 10 220-foot-long concrete girders into place. They will form the base of the new 70th Avenue overpass over I-5. She says it would have taken much longer if the contractor wasn't local.
Had these girders not been made close by in Tacoma, they were made at Concrete Technology Corp, I'm not sure that we could have done this, pulled this off.
So how's it going to work? How do you move 10 massive girders and set them in place in just 18 hours?
The girders will be loaded individually, each one individually, on this massive truck and moved onto I-5 during the overnight hours. And on I-5, we will station two cranes that will lift the girders and move them into their exact spot.
Workers will move 5 of the girders each night. There will also be some ramp closures before that 11 p.m. nightly closure to accommodate these huge loads. So you might be asking, why go big? Why go 220 feet? That seems a little excessive. Newborn says this design actually will save time on the freeway closures.
Using these super long girders allowed us to build the base of the bridge in a weekend. Had we chosen a more traditional shorter girder, we would have had to widen I-5 and build columns at the median, and that would have meant extensive lane closures over a long period of time.
This new overpass comes with all the bells and whistles and should provide a much improved trip into and out of the Port of Tacoma.
It will have 4 lanes, as well as pedestrian access and bicycle access. So it will be significantly bigger and accommodate not only more traffic, but people who want to walk and bike across I-5, which they could not do on the bridge that exists now.
And the existing overpass is only 2 lanes wide, and it backs up daily because it really can't handle the traffic, and because it's so short and, you know, it doesn't have as many lines. That's probably why we have that accident that's there right now this morning. With this new bridge, they will have a little bit more wiggle room. This overpass is really the first visible part of the new Gateway project, which we've been talking about for years. This finishes Highway 167 and Highway 509. If you're new to our area and have ever wondered why 167 just ends in Puyallup, well, it wasn't supposed to, but the leaders stopped funding for it decades ago. This project will finish that final 4 miles from Puyallup over to I-5. It's expected, though, that this section will be tolled, as will the improved 509 between I-5 and the Port of Tacoma. The final stages of the Gateway project will finish 509 at the south end of SeaTac Airport. It will actually provide a direct south entrance and exit to the airport from I-5, which is great. That section, however, also expected to be tolled. The new 70th Avenue overpass should be open to traffic in about a year.
I don't drive a lot through Fife, but you're saying this new overpass is expected to benefit trips in and out of the port at Tacoma? That's what that's for?
Yeah, primarily, and help Fife deal with all of that freight traffic right now that is jammed on 70th, which it can't handle, and 54th, and it backs up throughout the entire area. So this will help provide a much better access over the freeway, more capacity, and give a more direct route into the port for all the people coming out of the valley. Because right now you come down 167, so much freight moves through the valley there. You don't really realize that it's one of the largest freight hubs in the country is right there in the valley there. Yeah. And they all swing around and they have to use surface streets, River Road to get over to I-5 and into the port. So this should help things out tremendously. But to get there, we have to close the freeway. And trust me, we'll be talking about it a lot because it's not for a month. But yeah, it's never too soon to start planning for an I-5 closure.
Yeah, just two weekends though, yeah?
No, just two weekend nights.
It's
one weekend, but overnight hours on Friday night and Saturday night. They're going to put this thing in place in one weekend, which is actually impressive considering how large these girders are.
Chris Sullivan, thank you, Sully.
Yep.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Mara Soriano, she got some star-powered help to find a priceless teddy bear. Maybe you've already seen this. It's got a good ending. She lost her teddy bear when she was moving into a new apartment in Toronto with her fiance.
I was so hoping I left it in the U-Haul, and when they said no, my heart just sank.
She told ABC News that she ended up leaving it in a backpack, which she accidentally dropped outside of the U-Haul and left it alone for just 10 minutes. Surveillance video she later got from the apartment complex shows a man lingering, looking, and then grabbing it and taking off. The great teddy bear search then began because the bear was given to her by her mom before her mom died from cancer just last year. And the bear is special because it gives a recorded message from her mom when you squeeze the paw.
I love you, infinity and beyond.
Mara, armed with that surveillance video, reached out to the local news in her new city. And that's how actor Ryan Reynolds gets wrapped into the story. He offered on Twitter a $5,000 reward for the return of the bear, no questions asked. Well, it worked. Mara says she got an email from someone who knew the man who took the backpack and subsequently got the bear back to her. She described the exchange to the show Breakfast Television Toronto.
I got an email at 9:30 p.m. from the Good Samaritan that got the bear, and he had seen the video footage of the theft, and he recognized the person right away, so he's not the best guy, obviously, because he's going around stealing people's bags. So he liberated her from him, and he sent me an email, and we set up a safe space to meet up. I got the reporter who broke the news because this wouldn't have been possible without her, and we made the exchange, and I couldn't believe it actually happened. It is actually the mama bear.
Mara says she's full of hope thanks to the support she's received trying to get that bear back.
This outpouring of love and kindness and compassion and actually finding the bear was all her doing.
I'm assuming the $5,000 went to that person who got the bear back. I haven't seen that yet, but boy, it's sure nice when people get the support of not just celebrities, but sort of this is the good side of viral internet usage is when good people can come forward and make this happen.
Absolutely. Thank you, Colleen. And now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, we welcome in G. Scott. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
G, I know you were following that House hearing yesterday with some of the big tech company CEOs out there. It was supposed to be about antitrust accusations, but a lot of the House members there seem to want to talk about suppressing ideas on social media.
Well, you know, when I talk about this and I hear about these hearings and what they're asking and what they're talking about, all I can think about is conversations that I would have with my dad about social media, about the internet, about all of those things back then. And I think all of us were kind of in that way. We probably, maybe somebody talked us into it. But do you remember for a long time, there were people like, oh, I don't get on the internet. I don't need the social media. I don't want to pay attention to that. Nobody did. Even businesses were saying, nope, we're just going to keep our phone number out there. We're going to do things the old-fashioned way. And so here we are today. I don't think any of us thought that the control and the power that these companies have, that they would have this back then, because we didn't understand it. We didn't see it. I mean, yes, we watched the Jetsons, but the Jetsons just had flying cars. They had nothing about computers or anything being this far in advance. So when I see now, and I see the power that a Mark Zuckerberg has, or a Jack Dorsey from Twitter, even though he wasn't there, or we see what Amazon is doing, we're just like, oh boy, I guess we weren't prepared. So I do get fascinated, though, because I love to hear them get questioned, and I just see them. I'm just like, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook the way that he did, right? Just rating.
In college.
In college. For rating women, you know what I mean? Like, so that's exactly what it was. And then here it is today. This man has this much influence on the world.
Too much? I think it's too much. But
I think it's way too much.
Yeah. What makes me uncomfortable is when he says we don't want to be the arbiters of truth.
Right.
But he has you. The responsibility came to him. He might not have sought it out by creating Facebook, but it now exists, and therefore you must act. And he is so resistant to putting in any sort of safeguards or having that discussion. He just holds firm that, well, Facebook is a place where we want people to connect with their loved ones. Too late, Zuckerberg. It's gotten bigger than you now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just never thought that it would be that way. So now the question is, I mean, we all agree right now. We're saying, yes, they have too much power. How do you go about regulating that? And I think that the longer time goes and nothing is done, the worse it gets. I would have thought something would have been done 5-6 years ago. I mean, there is no, like, when they get fined for something like, oh, Facebook has been fined $50 million or $100 million, Mark Zuckerberg really goes up under the mattress and says, hey, I can't find my spare $100 million. Y'all seen that lately? Oh, there it is. It's in my pillowcase.
Well, here's a question for you too, G. I mean, what do you do when you find out? And I think it's fairly recognized now the influence that these social media sites have on us and the power of suggested influence too through advertisements and the algorithms that decide, you know, which feeds show up and that you see. Do you stay in it and fight it from within, or do you opt out and say, nope, don't want this in my brain?
Too late.
You think so?
It's too late to deactivate
your account?
Here's why it's too late. Like, you could deactivate it. Go ahead. No problem. But, I mean, it would be bad if we had a president of the United States actually see someone on social media that believes that the doctor that believes in demon semen and all that stuff, if they were to retweet that. Even if you don't have an account, you're going to hear that in your news. If you turn on the news, you know that that's going to be there because our president retweeted that. So you can deactivate your account all you want to. It's going to come at you. A lot of the news that we get, a lot of the information that we get, sometimes it comes from social media.
Is it too late, though, to try to add more regulations? I mean, Twitter and Facebook, they say they do their best to try to, you know, sniff out false information and, you know, suspend accounts and whatnot. But is there any more they can do, or any more federal regulation that could be put in place?
Yeah, I'd say we start taking the controls of it. I think our somehow, some way.
That could be government. Some would accuse that of government overreach.
So then that's where we are. Yeah. Like, I think our laws, the way they are set up, it is set up for them to continue their path. Like, there's nothing you can really do that's set up right now to touch them. They will continue this. So right now is 2020. Can you imagine the power that they'll have in 2030?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's what I'm saying. If everybody opts out, they have to make some changes, right? Market influence.
Ain't going to happen.
Colleen, mm-hmm. you can opt out personally, but can you do it for your job?
What do you mean it won't happen? We do it all the time with products.
Look what happened with Nike, with FedEx.
You boycott a product, and the company reacts.
Can you boycott it with your job, with what you do for a living, Colleen?
Sure. I did it before.
No. It's all right.
All right.
We can continue this tomorrow.
See you guys.
G. Scott, we'll hear you at 9 o'clock. Seattle pushed back on criticism over the response to Saturday's protests turned riots, and Mayor Jenny Durkin is weighing in on the effort to recall her. Here's Kyber Radio's Hannah Scott.
The criticism over the Seattle Police Department response to what started as a peaceful protest Saturday but turned into an hours-long battle on Capitol Hill was virtually instant, but Chief Carmen Best is laying out new evidence that some in the crowd came with the intent to turn things violent.
Over the past several weeks, we have seen many demonstrations throughout the city. Many demonstrators have been peaceful. However, many have not. Since July 19th, we have seen three protests where individuals have embedded themselves and where they were particularly destructive and violent inside the peaceful group. Last Saturday, a group of protesters went to the Youth Service Center where people within the group threw incendiary devices, Molotov cocktails, into a construction site which resulted in several trailers being destroyed by fire. The group went from the construction site to the East Precinct.
Then?
A van that was closely following the group arrived at the precinct with the group. People were seen removing items and distributing them to people within the group. These items were described as baseball bats, pyrotechnic explosives, APR respirators, improvised shields, and face masks. Moments later, an explosion blew an 8-inch hole into the wall of the East Precinct. Because of the manner in which the vehicle was parked and abandoned, there was a real fear that it would contain explosive devices that could detonate.
When they got a search warrant for that abandoned van,
pyrotechnic explosives, smoke bombs bundled together, able to cause large amounts of smoke that are caustic to humans, bear spray, using it on anything but bears is a federal offense, pepper spray, stun guns, improvised spike strips.
Besh says they're investigating to find those behind this organized effort, but she declined to offer much as far as detail in the investigation. As for Mayor Durkin,
the fires that were set this weekend, make no mistake about it, were very dangerous. Dangerous not just to the people who were in and around those premises, but dangerous to the firefighters who respond.
With nightly protests ongoing in the city, Durkin made this plea again to those taken to the streets.
Acts of destruction, violence, and hateful speech, none of that gets us to where we need to be. It's not just a distraction, it undermines the central message and the actions we want to take together as a city.
On top of the demand to defund SPD, many in the protests also want the mayor to resign and have even started a recall effort that was greenlit last month by a judge. Durkin asked the court to reconsider that decision, but yesterday the judge said no, leaving that recall a real possibility. Durkin had this to say about it yesterday.
I was elected to be mayor of Seattle. It's a democracy, and if sometime the voters decide they don't want me, that's all right, too. I think that this is, we've got three great challenges, and my focus is, how do we keep people healthy in a pandemic? How do we, you know, help people who are suffering from this economic devastation? And how do we take the voices in the street and transmit that into sustainable change for a better and more just society?
Skyro Radio's Hannah Scott, she joins us live now. Let's talk about this effort to recall the mayor. What are the next steps now in this?
I believe it's still in the signature gathering phase so that they can get it to the ballot is what they want to do. So the judge and the initial green lighting of that just has to find the cause. And she found a cause in one particular area. I think there were seven things that they said that she had done wrong. And the recall effort mainly cites the response to a prior protest that was looked very similar to what we saw on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Anyways, the mayor said that kind of fell to the chief and that wasn't really something that she had the power over in her challenge to try to stop the recall being allowed to go forward. And the judge said no. She disagreed. So now they have to gather the signatures to get it to the ballot.
As for this stockpile of weapons that was found in a van on Saturday, I heard Durkin describes this as well organized with this kind of destructive power. Have we heard it all from the group who organized this protest, the Youth Liberation Front?
I've not seen them responding specifically to what this announcement was yesterday. I have seen others who are part of the demonstrations that are ongoing in the city really complain and say, you know, these are just fireworks. These aren't anything that will hurt the officers. They're not much of a threat. And I would have to disagree with that, especially in the way that they were used, how they were bundled together and things like that. And the bear mace is a concern. Right. They had an officer at this yesterday describing how much more painful and how hard that is on an officer compared to a regular pepper spray or something.
Any suspects or leads in that case?
I don't know if there are or not. She was Chief Bass, very, very tight-lipped, did not want to share anything, but she's definitely got a very intense investigation going on for these people. Somebody asked, I think, about, you know, you've had the van, you can't look up the registration, and she's like, I'm not going to get into any of that right now. But the overall message was, look, there are people, small groups who come in into these demonstrations intent on causing this kind of destruction, intent on kind of enticing the reaction that you see from police. And it's an organized effort from basically anti-government people who are both in Portland, here in Seattle, and some of the other places we've seen demonstrations across the country.
And lastly, Hannah, I also heard the mayor say that the city's Office of Police Accountability will continue to investigate complaints made against officers, hoping to hold the police accountable there. Any evidence yet that any officers did indeed act with, you know, this without discretion?
No, not as of yet. And look, it takes time for them to dig into that. That's pretty standard. I will say, you know, there's that challenge that the Black Lives Matter and ACLU wanted the SPD in Seattle to be found in contempt of the order over the crowd control weapons. The city responded to that yesterday and saying, basically, look, there's no evidence here so far, as it's early, that any officer acted without good faith and didn't act in a reasonable way. And also they point out, if there is one or two officers that do end up being found to have acted poorly, that doesn't allow for the entire department to be held accountable.
Skyward Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my bell. Rachel Bell.
1-800-242-0100. Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien along with Aaron Granillo this morning and Chris Sullivan, of course. Rachel Bell is here with some helpful information on how to get outdoors and not get backed up.
Yes. So I will tell a personal story first. So a couple weeks ago, I went to Rainier National Park, Mount Rainier National Park, and it was packed because everyone has the same idea. You're not flying. Everyone is road tripping. They're doing these trips closer to home. And we tried to go to the sunrise entrance of the park to go do a hike, and were stopped 20 miles before we even got to the entrance by uniformed officers who pulled us over and said, you can't get in the line. It is several miles backed up. It's going to be hours before you can get in. There's no spots in the parking lot. It's one car out, one car in. Please come back in 2 to 3 hours.
Even if they let you in and let you line up, would you have done it anyways? I feel like that defeats the purpose of the serenity of nature, to have to wait in line for hours to do it.
Well, the thing is there are plenty of other places you can go hiking without going into those official entrances in the park. You can still hike at Rainier without going through. So we changed our plan and we did another hike. But I wanted to make sure that this didn't happen to other people, because we happened to be camping nearby. But if you had come all the way from home and you couldn't get in, it would be really disappointing. So I spoke with Kevin Bacher. He's the spokesperson for Mount Rainier National Park. He says if you can come Monday through Thursday, that's when it's going to be less busy. If you have to come in the weekend, early morning or late afternoon. But how early is early?
It's getting earlier and earlier, Rachel, because I think people are realizing that you have to get here early. And so more and more people are doing so. And so the lines are getting long earlier and earlier in the day. And just to give you an example, I was over at Sunrise myself on this past Saturday and hit the line at 8:30 and waited about half an hour. So I would recommend, if possible, that people get to the park before 8 a.m.
That's so, nothing. That's not early.
Well,
for
if it's already
somebody who wakes up at 3:30.
Yeah. But a lot of people, if you're coming from the city and you have to drive 3 hours, you can't get there by 8:30 in the morning. So you have to get up real early. So one place to try to get some information before you go is to go to their Twitter account.
And our Twitter is Mount Rainier NPS. If you go there, that is kept up to date with information about what the traffic is like in the park and when the parking lots get full. Now, one of the challenges there is that you lose access to cell service as you get close to the park. So you kind of have to check that in advance, and you have to know what the patterns are and know that if you're coming on a Saturday, it's going to get full, and it's going to get full pretty quick.
So a couple other things. The visitor centers are all closed right now because they don't want people inside that enclosed space. But they do have rangers set up outside to help people answer questions. They still have rangers on the trails that you can talk to. Some of the hotels within the park are closed. Some are open. Some restaurants are open. Some are closed. You can find all this information by going to their website.
But one of the best things to do is to plan ahead, be prepared. Bring food with you, bring all of your supplies with you, have in mind what you want to do for the day, but also have a second or third option in mind in case you get to your first option and find it overwhelmed with people, and that's not the experience that you're looking for.
That is crucial, because we had to go with the second plan, but like he said, you don't have cell service, so we couldn't look at WTA.org, which is the really great hiking website, because you couldn't access it. So we had to rack our brains of where can we go, where is it, trying to go from memory of past trips, but not everybody has that. Yeah. But they are looking for a solution to all of this.
This issue of large crowds wanting to come into the national parks is something that has been building for many years, both here at Mount Rainier and also at other national parks around the country. And if you think it's bad here, there are other parks like Zion, Yosemite, Glacier National Park that have even worse problems than we do. But this is definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. And we have a couple of efforts that we're starting in the next couple of months to try to get some public input and find out from people's experiences like yours what people are actually experiencing, and to get some input on what the best way is to manage this. Do we have reservations for the park? Do we have quotas for the park? Do we have people lining up for 4 hours waiting to get in as we do now? Do we need better information so that people know what to expect when they get here and know that the lines are going to be long? So all of those are things that we're trying to figure out so that we can avoid the experience that you had last weekend.
And I'm going to stay up to date with them. So when that survey comes out, I will do another story so anybody listening can take the survey and participate.
That website you mentioned, is that a good one to go to if you want to try to find an off the beaten path hiking trail?
Yes. I cannot recommend WTA.org enough. There is no state in the country that has as good of a hiking website as we have here. We're so lucky. It's Washington Trails Association. They also maintain a very large percentage of the hikes, or the trails rather, in the state. And so there's all kinds of things you could check on there, like how many miles you want to go, elevation, do you want to see wildflowers, is it dog friendly, is it good for kids? You can narrow it down by location. You can do all of these things. It's the most comprehensive website basically in the country, and we're really lucky to have it. So, you know, that's for all hikes in the state. So if you're at Rainier and you want to avoid the most popular hikes, use WTA.org.
Thank you for this investigative report, Rachel.
You're welcome. This is what it's like. I apply my own life's problems and I try to share them with other people.
They're universal.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.